Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is For the Record program number 279, titled, Tabulate This, IBM, the Third Reich, World War II, and the Holocaust. This is being recorded on February 25th of the year 2001. In past discussions, both of a recent book titled IBM and the Holocaust and in an attendant lawsuit that has been filed against IBM over their collaboration with the Third Reich, I've detailed my questions concerning not only the timing and the publicity that has surrounded the publication of this very excellent book, and also the timing and publicity surrounding the lawsuit. I do think that possibly the publication of this book by a Bertelsmann subsidiary, and also the timing and publication, or the filing of this lawsuit, may very well figure prominently in the geopolitics of corporate globalization, and possibly in the fiscal exoneration of some of the German corporations that collaborated with the Third Reich. However, my hypothetical construct concerning the possible applications of the book and the lawsuit are not to be misunderstood in any way as being cynical about the book or exonerating of IBM's role with the Third Reich and the Holocaust and World War II. In this program, we're going to explore not only the remarkable recent book by Edwin Black titled IBM and the Holocaust, but the role of IBM and its head, Thomas J. Watson, with the Third Reich and the Holocaust, and we're going to take a look at some implications for today. We're going to begin by taking a look at the Los Angeles Times of Monday, February 19th of the year 2001. This is an op-ed column by Michael D. Hausfeld, H-A-U-S-F-E-L-D, an attorney in Washington, D.C., who has represented Holocaust survivors and is representing the plaintiffs in this IBM lawsuit. The op-ed column is titled, IBM Technology Helped Facilitate the Holocaust, and skipping down of IBM, its Dehomag, D-E-H-O-M-A-G subsidiary, and their use of Hollerith machines, H-O-L-L-E-R-I-T-H, we read, skipping down, upon arrival, a, quote, selection, unquote, process separated those who could be used as slave laborers from those destined for immediate extermination. Victims with some potential for labor were often worked to death. The total number of people who perished in concentration camps, not including those sent to extermination camps, is estimated to be between 700,000 to 1.2 million. IBM USA knew that its Hollerith machines were needed and used in the camps. IBM USA kept careful records of where its leased property was located and played an active role in servicing those machines, training its clients how to use them, and providing punch cards and other supplies. IBM USA's inventories of 1940 and 1941 indicate that the company knew which Hollerith machines were located in camps, along with their serial numbers and the amount they were being paid for the lease of each machine. At Dachau alone, there were approximately 24 IBM sorters, tabulators, and printers. Nazi personnel had to be trained by IBM staff in how to use the tabulators, sorters, and other Hollerith machines. Salespersons and officials from IBM Germany and IBM subsidiaries in Europe in turn would come to New York for training, sometimes at significant expense to IBM USA. And skipping down, once the United States entered the war on December 10, 1941, IBM USA camouflaged its business transactions with the Nazi regime by using its European subsidiaries as a facade. By the way, that's a gambit that was not unusual for many of the transnational corporations that were working both in the United States and actively aiding the Axis, as we've seen in numerous broadcasts available from Spitfire. Continuing. As late as November 13, 1944, a German prisoner of war, formerly the branch manager of the Saarbrücken and Hollerith office, noted in an intelligence bulletin that the Hollerith company did not conceal or sever its connection with IBM. At all relevant times, IBM USA controlled its operations in Germany. It provided the technology, machinery, and material solely because that was its business. The IBM experience with Nazi Germany teaches three lessons. All that is benign, the compiling, sorting, and classifying of information through technology, is not necessarily harmless. The pursuit of profit, indifferent to its consequences or effects, can be an evil unto itself. And crimes against humanity are not limited to the perpetrators who define or sign the orders of extermination, pull the triggers, drop the pellets, or crack the whips. Those who aid, abet, or consciously participate in the furtherance of those crimes have their own legal responsibility for which they must be held legally accountable. Amen. And I think there is a very profound lesson about both social, political, and corporate morality to be gleaned from that particular column. Now, in addition to aiding via its computing capabilities or tabulating capabilities, the classification of citizens under its control for potential use as slave laborers or to be exterminated, IBM was deeply involved with the Third Reich, and in fact, the centralization and categorization capabilities that IBM machines made possible were absolutely essential to the centralization and consequent control of the German economy as a central and essential element of its preparation for war. This is discussed in the remarkable book that I'm about to excerpt. That book is called IBM and the Holocaust, subtitled The Strategic Alliance Between Nazi Germany and America's Most Powerful Corporation. The book was authored by Edwin Black. It's published in hardcover by Crown Books, a subsidiary of Random House, in turn, by the way, owned by Bertelsmann. Copyright 2001 by Edwin Black. The ISBN number is 0-609-60799-5. And in addition to classifying citizens for potential use as slave laborers or for extermination, as I just indicated, the use of IBM tabulating machines was absolutely essential for the centralization and coordination of the German economy in preparation for war. Edwin Black writes about this, saying, Germany was quietly tabulating, while Hitler's rhetoric was burning the parade grounds and airwaves, while stormtroopers were marching Jews through the streets in ritual humiliations, while Reich legislative decrees and a miasma of regional and private policies were ousting Jews from their professions and residences, while noisy, outrageous acts of persecution were appalling the world, a quieter process was also underway. Germany was automating. Hollerith systems could do more than count. They could schedule, analyze, and compute. They could manage. Several dozen Hollerith systems were already in use by a small clique of German industrial firms and government offices. But now, Hitler's Reich discovered that in its quest for supremacy, it could mechanize, organize, and control virtually all aspects of private and commercial life from the largest industrial cartel to the humblest local shopkeeper. Just as people would be categorized and regimented down to the least characteristic, so would all of German business be analyzed to the smallest detail and then subject to Nazi discipline. The economy could recover. People could go back to work, but it would all be done toward a single, totally coordinated Nazi goal. A global movement was loudly organizing to shatter the German economy and topple the repressive Hitler regime by denying economic recovery, prolonging German joblessness, and boycotting German commerce. But IBM was mobilizing its financial and engineering might to do the opposite. General Manager Röttke, R-O-T-T-K-E, echoed IBM's attitude at the Lichterfelde factory opening, declaring, quote, "We are able to hereby assist our government in its battle against unemployment," unquote. Work and bread was the theme IBM and Dehomag used again and again to describe their venture, all in support of the National Socialist goal. As Heidinger told his audience, quote, "Public interest prevails over private interest," unquote. That was a German IBM official. Continuing, Hollerith technology had become a German administrative way of life. Punch cards would enable the entire Reich to go on a war footing. For IBM, it was a bonanza. Dehomag's client list sparkled. Electrical combines such as Siemens in Berlin and Lech Elektrizitätswerke in Augsburg. Heavy industries such as Mannesmann in Dusseldorf and IG Farben in Frankfurt. Automakers such as Opel in Rüsselsheim and Daimler-Benz in Stuttgart. Retail stores such as Woolworth and Hertie in Berlin. Optical manufacturers such as Zeiss in Jena and Zeiss Icon in Dresden. Chocolate factories such as Schokoladenfabrik in Tangermünde. Coffee producers such as Kaffeehandel's Aktiengesellschaft in Bremen. Aircraft engines, 10 customers. Coal mining, 7 customers. Chemical plants, 18 customers. Electrical products, 10 customers. Motor vehicle industry, 11 customers. Shipbuilders, 2 customers. Railroads, buses, trams, and other transportation, 32 customers. Insurance companies, 26 customers. banks, 6 customers, public utilities, 16 customers, iron and steel, 19 customers, turbines, engines, and tractors, 7 customers, leather tanning, washing machine manufacture, liquor, paint, and varnishes, cigarettes, perfumes, railway car assembly, ball bearings, rubber, petroleum, shoes, oleomargarine, asbestos, and explosives. Reichspost, Reichsbahn, pension funds, the Luftwaffe, the Navy. Payroll, inventory control, material strength calculations, personnel, finance, scheduling, product usage, and manufacturing supervision. There was virtually no business that could not benefit from punch card technology. Dehamag deftly controlled the data operations of the entire Third Reich. Moreover, one Dehamag customer account could represent dozens of machines. Hollerith Systems involved an ensemble of interconnected devices that could be manufactured in a variety of configurations. Punchers, proofers, verifiers, sorters, tabulators, alphabetizers, multipliers, printers. IG Farben installed arrays in Offenbach, Bitterfeld, Berlin, Hoechst, and other locations. Daimler-Benz utilized machines in Berlin, Stuttgart, Genshagen, and other sites. Junkers employed Hollerith devices in Magdeburg, Leopoldshall, Köthen, Dessau, and numerous other cities. Municipalities everywhere used the machines. Frankfurt am Main's Public Works Department alone maintained an extended suite of punchers, verifiers, tabulators, multipliers, and sorters. Statistical offices, federal, regional, and local, could not lease enough systems. Gleichschaltung, that is, total central coordination, demanded that endless accountings be submitted regularly to government bureaus, Nazified trade associations, and statistical agencies. Actually, let me read that again. Gleichschaltung, that is, total central coordination, demanded that endless accountings be submitted regularly to government bureaus, Nazified trade associations, and statistical agencies. Commissars and government regulations required companies to install Hollerith machines to ensure prompt, uniform, up-to-the-minute reports that could be reprocessed and further tabulated. The Reich Statistical Office's Department 1 was officially charged with the responsibility of helping companies transition to the elaborate Hollerith methodology. Statistical bureaus hired thousands of new staffers just to keep up with the data flow. Hitler's Germany began achieving undreamed-of efficiencies. The Reichsbahn was a vital customer for Dehamag, deploying full or partial systems in Essen, Cologne, Nuremberg, Mainz, Frankfurt, Hanover, and nearly every other major connection point. Some 140 million passengers annually were booked through Dehamag cart sorting systems. Punch cards made the trains run on time and even calculated engine efficiency when pulling certain types of freight. Records in some railway operations that previously required 300 people 6 months to organize could now be computed by a staff of 15 working for just a week. Customers such as Krupp, Siemens, and the Deutsche Bank were able to reduce their operating costs and clerical staffs by as much as half and plow those human and financial resources into sellable goods and services. Manpower could be shifted as needed from plant to plant by companies and deployed from city to city by the German labor front. To meet fast expanding demand, Dehamag hired more than 1,000 new employees to staff the new factory at Lichterfelde. No, everywhere throughout the plant, newly installed machine tools were fabricating Hollerith devices. Workshops buzzed, cranked, and whirred with Belling & Lubke precision lathes, Jung surface grinders, Bowley milling machines, Hille high-speed drills, Auerbach and Scheibe three-spindle drill presses, Teal metal saws, Karger thread-cutting lathes, and universal grinding machines. Metal shavings, oil cans, iron rods, tin coils, ball bearings, alloy sheets, and rubber rollers combined with bent elbows, squinting eyes, wedging hands and brows wiped by the sleeves of work smocks to create a manufacturing miracle. IBM zeal and Nazi devotion coalesced to help the Reich recover and strengthen. Lichterfelde was overwhelmed with orders. It established a shock department, unquote, for the speedy manufacture of spare parts, retrofitted an old, disused IBM plant from pre-merger days, and converted it to a workshop. Outside storage, some 1,200 square meters costing more than 12,000 Reichsmarks annually, was rented. Workmen shuttled materials back and forth from the storage site to the overcrowded Lichterfelde site, where even corridor space was at a premium. Our own workshops technical grew to such an extent, complained Heidinger in a report to IBM New York, again quoting, that every square meter of space was overfilling with machines and persons, and the acute shortage of space became more and more critical. And that's about the centralization of the German economy made possible by the tabulating and calculating capabilities of Dehomag, the IBM German subsidiary's Hollerith machines. And again, it was absolutely essential to the German war economy. Now, Thomas J. Watson, the head of IBM, was an enthusiastic supporter of the Third Reich, and just as in Uncle Sam and the Swastika, recorded on May 23rd of 1980, relayed the account of how Henry Ford was bestowed a very high medal by Adolf Hitler, so too Thomas Watson was honored by Hitler and the Third Reich. Turning to IBM and the Holocaust, we read, Thomas Watson was more than just a businessman selling boxes to the Third Reich. For his Promethean gift of punch card technology that enabled the Reich to achieve undreamed of efficiencies both in its rearmament program and its war against the Jews, for his refusal to join the chorus of strident anti-Nazi boycotters and isolators and instead open a commercial corridor the Reich could still navigate, for his willingness to bring the world's commercial summit to Berlin, for his value as a Roosevelt crony, for his glitter and legend, Hitler would bestow upon Thomas Watson a medal, the highest it could confer on any non-German. The Merit Cross of the German Eagle with Star was created for Thomas Watson to, quote, honor foreign nationals who made themselves deserving of the German Reich, unquote. And that, by the way, was the award that Henry Ford received from Adolf Hitler as well, the Cross of the German Eagle. Mussolini was one of the first foreigners to receive it. Henry Ford was another. And that, again, is discussed in the Miscellaneous Archive show Uncle Sam and the Swastika, recorded on May 23rd of 1980, and that's available from Spitfire. Thomas Watson also was very, very enthusiastic about trying to organize a trade consortium and a series of trade arrangements between key Axis and Allied businessmen, or businessmen of countries that would become Allied nations. This in order to establish a series of international trade agreements that would guarantee the free movement of raw materials. These agreements were seen, ideally speaking, and were rationalized as preventing war. But as we shall see, in fact, war was the raison d'etre for these particular agreements. I don't want to appear to be reading too much into the passages I'm about to read, but yet, in an era of globalization and with the importance of free trade and globalized corporate economy being stressed as a good way to prevent war, precisely because nations wouldn't go to war over economics matters, and that has, as a point of fact, been cited in addition to the glories of the free marketplace, that has been cited as a rationalization for many of the global trade agreements, including the World Trade Organization. I don't think it is entirely out of line to see in the arrangements that Thomas Watson tried to make perhaps a precursor of some of the global trade agreements that are now in effect or about to take effect. Again, I'm not stressing this is a hard connection, but listen to the following and assess my ruminations for yourself. Returning to IBM and the Holocaust by Edwin Black, in Copenhagen, at the International Chamber of Commerce Congress, Watson's pro-Axis proposal exceeded anything the State Department could have expected. He championed a resolution whereby private businessmen from the three Axis and three Allied nations would actually supersede their governments and negotiate a radical new international trade policy designed to satisfy Axis demands for raw materials coveted from other nations. The businessmen would then lobby their respective governments' official economic advisors to adopt their appeasement proposals for the sake of averting war. Ironically, the raw materials were needed by Axis powers solely for the sake of waging war. On June 28th, under Watson's leadership, the International Chamber of Commerce passed a resolution again calling for, quote, a fair distribution of raw materials, foodstuffs, and other products to render unnecessary the movements of armies across frontiers, unquote. To this end, the ICC asked, again quoting, "The governments of France, Germany, Italy, Japan, the United Kingdom, and the United States each collaborate with their own leading businessmen with respect to national needs, and therefore give all countries of the world a fair opportunity to share in the resources of the world." And skipping down, so enthusiastic was Watson that he quickly wrote to President Roosevelt attaching transcripts from the conference and explaining that the concept of a private survey by businessmen to resolve and rewrite trade barriers was his invention. Quote, "You will note that this resolution does not suggest a political conference," unquote, Watson pointed out to the president, stressing the non-governmental procedure. But he added, once the private recommendations were tendered, the six nations might then call for an international meeting to ratify the suggestions. And again, one wonders whether perhaps this proposal for a free trade agreement to be structured by major businessmen of six different countries, including the Axis nations, might be to a certain extent a harbinger of some of the global trade agreements that have been struck in the years since. Those have been rationalized as being essential for preventing war. What we're going to look at now is the work of Harold J. Carter of the Economic Warfare Section of the Department of Justice and his work in attempting to interdict at first effort the IBM collaboration with the Third Reich, then realizing the impossibility of that, resigning himself to the fact that the very centralization and tabulated nature of the German war economy was deemed to be essential for the post-war, quote, economic recovery, unquote, of Germany, and that therefore the continuation of IBM in a position of power in the post-war economy was deemed essential. In other words, IBM transcended the political and military factors, and that is very similar to what we've looked at in, among other broadcasts, Uncle Sam, the aforementioned Uncle Sam and the swastika. Edwin Black describes this, writing, "In 1943, as Harold J. Carter sat in IBM's offices at 590 Madison Avenue, he was investigating more than a powerful business. Carter never had a chance. He was going against a corporation that was intensely vital to almost every aspect of the U.S. war effort, including its most secret operations, and against executives who occupied the glittering apex of America's rally for defense. In fact, Watson even declined a recent Democratic suggestion to run for governor of New York. No wonder Schotta could decide what documents Carter would and would not receive. IBM and Watson were untouchable. Carter learned the immutable truth in the very words he had written months earlier, quote, "This world war is a conflict of warlike nationalistic states, each having certain interests. Yet we frequently find these interests clashing diametrically with the opposing interests of international corporate structures, more huge and powerful than nations." IBM was in some ways bigger than the war. Both sides could not afford to proceed without the company's all-important technology. Hitler needed IBM, so did the Allies. By late 1943, Carter learned that whether he concurred or not, IBM was not to be treated as a suspect corporation trading with the enemy, but as a precious war asset in the Allied struggle for liberty. IBM now entered a wholly new phase. Since all of Nazi Europe administratively functioned with Hollerith's, IBM's help would be crucial to the post-war control of Europe's administrative and economic infrastructure. Simply put, IBM had the keys to Europe, or rather the cards. Now, all its expertise in punch card technology would be utilized to create an orderly conquest and liberation of the continent. Carter's economic warfare section now regularly turned to IBM to learn the many intricacies of German and Italian Hollerith use, not for the purposes of criminal prosecution or documenting culpability, but for the purposes of military intelligence and sustaining an Allied victory. Skipping down, one of Carter's colleagues, Harold Unger, prepared another confidential memo further outlining the new approach. Quote, "The German government," wrote Unger, "through the intensive use of standardized accounting practices and business machines, has achieved a highly centralized control of the financial and industrial activities of Germany and of the occupied countries. This control is so centralized that a sudden collapse of the German government may produce such chaos in the functioning of the German economy as to make extremely difficult whatever administration the Allied authorities may seek to impose after the war. Whatever system the occupation authorities intend to adopt, therefore, One action with high priority is to prepare in advance to seize and utilize the existing German economic apparatus. IBM had come full circle. The firm had now become a strategic partner in the war against the Third Reich, even as it continuously supplied the enemy, as before, through its overseas subsidiaries. Carter's investigation was finished. The crusade to save the machines was on. And again, this is not to be cynical about this remarkable book or the lawsuit, but I do wonder about the great publicity, including a full-page ad in the New York Times that surrounds this. Usually books of this type, detailing corporate collaboration with the Axis powers in World War II, get buried, and in general books discussing the fascistic inclinations of many of our national icons do not get much, if any, publicity. For example, we're going to take a look at a book about the dark side of Walt Disney, including some of his fascist inclinations. Walt Disney is an American icon, and yet this book, titled Walt Disney, Hollywood's Dark Prince, a biography by Mark Elliott, was suppressed. The book was published by a Birch Lane Press, a subsidiary of Carroll Publishing Group, copyright 1993, and this book did not get a lot of publicity. It came out, but it was, the ISBN number, by the way, 1-55972-174-X, and see if you've ever heard the following. The Lessing referred to here is Disney's lawyer, Gunther Lessing, who helped him to suppress labor organization within the Disney film empire. During the time Disney helped organize the independent filmmakers against the industry's mainstream, he also was accompanying Lessing to American Nazi Party meetings and rallies. According to Arthur Babbitt, quote, "In the immediate years before we entered the war, there was a small but fiercely loyal and, I suppose, legal following of the Nazi Party. You could buy a copy of Mein Kampf on any newsstand in Hollywood. Nobody asked me to go to any meetings, but I did out of curiosity. They were open meetings, anybody could attend, and I wanted to see what was going on for myself. On more than one occasion, I observed Walt Disney and Gunther Lessing there, along with a lot of other prominent Nazi-affiliated Hollywood personalities. Disney was going to meetings all the time. I was invited to the homes of several prominent actors and musicians, all of whom were actively working for the American Nazi Party. I told a girlfriend of mine, who was an editor at the time with Coronet magazine, who encouraged me to write down what I observed. She had some connections to the FBI and turned in my reports." If Disney and Lessing were sympathetic to the American Nazi movement, their interest was most likely motivated by the desire to regain favor with the once lucrative Nazi-occupied countries where Disney films were now banned. To that end, Walt was also committed to the America First movement and became one of Hollywood's most active pre-war isolationists. Skipping down. In her memoirs, German filmmaker Leni Riefenstahl claims that after the Kristallnacht, she approached every studio in Hollywood looking for work. No studio head would even screen her movies except Walt Disney. He told her that he admired her work, but if it became known that he was considering hiring her, it would damage his reputation. And I don't think you're going to hear too much about that. That concludes this broadcast. Before we wrap things up, there is a list of and description of the various tapes that I've produced over the years. That is available from Spitfire, and you can access a detailed and annotated description of For the Record program number 279 at the Spitfire website at www.spitfirelist.com. The For the Record segments are now being archived by WFMU-FM in Jersey City, New Jersey. You can access real audio archives of For the Record programs at their website at wfmu.org/Dave Emory, DaveEmory. That concludes For the Record program number 279, titled Tabulate This, IBM, the Third Reich, the Holocaust, and the Second World War. This is being recorded on February 25th of the year 2001. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.